Hello and welcome to the sixth episode of the XPRIZE Cars podcast. I'm Eric Boyd, and today I bring you an interview I conducted with John Shore, Senior Director of the Automotive XPRIZE, on March 21st, 2008 at the New York Auto Show. John Shore has been heavily involved in negotiations with the prize sponsors, you know, potential prize sponsors, and government agencies who are going to help them out, and he's also been sort of the leading man on developing the rules and the draft guidelines and things like that. So he was very interesting to talk to, and I got very techie with him. If you're interested in the details of the Automotive XPRIZE, I think this interview will fascinate you. So without further ado, here's John Shore.
I'm here with John Shore, Senior Director of the Automotive XPRIZE. He's been involved in the development of the rules and a bunch of other things, so we're going to have an interesting conversation. Can you explain, John, what it is you do for the Automotive XPRIZE?
Well, we all do a little bit of everything. My areas of concentration have been on our government relations, our relations with the federal agencies that have not only endorsed us but have been helping us in rules development and will help us in the administration of the competition. And another primary role of mine has been in the development of the draft guidelines and the work we're doing now to refine those guidelines.
I know that there were a lot of very interesting discussions in the early going of the Automotive XPRIZE about possible alternate rules, like, you know, not having a race at all, but having a sort of a production contest, first to 10,000 cars and other things. Could you talk about some of the ideas you considered and then rejected?
Yeah, I probably can't remember many of them. The version of the draft guidelines that we published for comment last year was, I think, number six, not all of which were drastically different. But the one that I think you're alluding to was one of the early ones in which the race, or what turned into the race, was a sales race. So we were going to determine the winner by a sales race rather than through some other mechanisms. The motivation for that, or the justification for that, was that sales, in many ways, served as a proxy for lots of stuff we care about: consumer acceptability, cost, producibility, supportability in the field, and stuff like that. Since at the end of the day, we're trying to stimulate the development of a wide range of options for consumers, the easiest way to measure whether you've done that is to measure sales. We backed off from that for two fundamental reasons. One reason we backed off is because the folks who were involved in developing the rules with us, who were media people and press people, said, boring, sales race is boring, we won't cover it, nobody will be interested in it until it's over. So if one of your goals is to generate widespread publicity and interest in the vehicles, that's not going to work. The other reason we backed off was that for a sales race to occur in 2010 or 11 or 12, even 2012, that far out, we would be limiting the serious competitors to companies that have designs that are already well underway, and companies that are very well positioned to sell a lot of vehicles. So it would have given the large manufacturers, should they have entered, a huge advantage over everybody else, and an unfair advantage, because we know that a manufacturer can move vehicles if they seriously want to, and if they decided we're going to move vehicles in order to win this sales race, it'd be very hard to prevent them from doing so.
Yeah, they could sell them below cost and other tricks.
And you could try to build in ways to avoid that, but it gets messier and messier. So that it's really two reasons, besides the lack of media interest. Number one, it would limit the extent of innovation, because most of the innovation would have to be ready today in order to sell in large quantities to win, large enough quantities to win. And second of all, it sounds like a great fair way to evaluate the success of a team. In fact, it's rather difficult to make that a fair contest.
Yeah, you'd need millions.
Kind of like the MIT class.
Now, another
and then it'll go into the engineer
sort of different cut of the rules from where we ended up today was much more focused on the life cycle environmental impact of the vehicles. Our advisor, Bill McDonough, who wrote Cradle to Cradle, was a very big influence on our work. We really admire him. We like him a lot. He was quite involved with us in some of the early stages of the rules. And we had a version of the guidelines that really could be described as a cradle-to-cradle contest. And we backed off from that because, well, we haven't changed our mind at all about that approach and the goals. When we considered what our basic mission was, which was to stimulate a new generation of vehicles to reduce our dependence on oil and to stem the effects of climate change, focusing on a cradle-to-cradle environmental approach wasn't dead on with our basic mission. So those are two examples of very different orientations of the draft guidelines that preceded the one that we published.
That's very interesting. You mentioned briefly the major automotive manufacturers, and I know from my website that this is a very important issue. There's a lot of people who really want to see the major automotive manufacturers participate in race and the prize. So if you could talk a little bit about maybe, you know, have you approached them or what have they said?
Well, first of all, we are among those who would love to see them compete. You know, many people have a rather strong attitude about the OEs or the OEMs, blaming them for the problems we have today, blaming them for focusing automotive ingenuity on power and weight rather than on other factors, conspiracy-type theorist blame, saying that they have all sorts of innovations that they have deliberately kept on the shelf in order to sell more high-powered vehicles because they want, they're in cahoots with the oil companies. There are all kinds of attitudes like that out there. We don't subscribe to any of that.
Yeah, it's the who killed the electric car talk, right?
Exactly. We really don't spend time trying to figure out who's right and who's wrong because we're looking ahead, not behind. And it's very clear to us that the automakers like to say, well, they're just selling what people want to buy. And to a large extent, that clearly is the case. And the auto industry, they have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders, and they're doing what they're supposed to do in the business world. So we certainly don't blame them for that. It's very clear to us that they are a very important part of the solution. New companies, like the ones that are currently looking to compete in our contest, clearly can get in the market at, you know, several tens of thousands of vehicles a year. But right now, within, you know, 5 to 10 year outlook, there isn't anybody who can put out millions of vehicles per year other than the OEMs. So they're clearly a very big part of solving this problem. And they're, as everybody knows from their advertising and some of their vehicle introductions, they're working hard to try to be a part of that.
GM Bulls, right?
So, you know, we view what we're doing as a win for them in that, in a number of ways, if they don't compete. One way is we're going to help build the market for these high-efficiency vehicles, and they'll be the winners in that. Another way is that we hope that some new innovations come out of this work, and it will be copied, licensed, purchased, who knows what, or perhaps only encourage them to innovate faster themselves. So we think what we're doing is good for them no matter what, and it's not harmful to them, so it's not an either-or. We think that if they joined and competed, it would be even better for them for at least two reasons. One reason is we think if they were competing, they would innovate faster. It's nothing like a contest to get people's juices flowing, and we think that an OEM that is serious about moving faster in the direction of more efficient and cleaner vehicles, it would be smart of them to stimulate their engineering departments by entering the competition. We also think that it would be beneficial to them because of the publicity they would get. They don't have to win the prize. It's very clear to us that a number of the OEMs could produce a production-capable vehicle that would perform very well. And if it performs very well, doesn't need to win, performs very well, and then it actually goes into production and for sale, they win in the marketplace. We demand that our cars be production-capable, but clearly not all of the vehicles in this race will be going into production, and perhaps the winner won't even go into production, because that's a pretty tall order. So we think that it would be a win for them in terms of stimulating their own innovation, as well as for giving them the kind of beneficial publicity that would help them win in the marketplace. So the other part of your question, we have been talking to them for a long time. We talked to all of them. I think it's fair to say that we have good relations with all of them. We have very open conversations, even at the engineering level, talking about how their vehicles might perform. But we understand that it's a risky decision for them. They're large companies. It's not so easy to say, well, let's do it. It's also clear that it's a harder decision to make when our rules are not final. It's a lot easier for a newcomer to say, whatever the rules are, we'll compete.
Yeah.
So we understand where they're coming from. We continue to talk to them. Our suspicion is that at least one of them is going to join us pretty soon.
Can you name names?
No, of course not. Nice try. And when that happens, first of all, the company that does that first will get a lot of publicity, and I think rightfully so. And I think others will follow because then the pressure on them will go up. I do think that it's going to be easier for them to make this decision now that we've officially launched. Prior to our launch, if I put myself in the position of a car company, a major car company, I would say, well, how real are these guys? We love what they're doing, and I truly believe they do like what we're doing. But, we didn't have a title sponsor. They didn't know who it would be. Was it a company they feel comfortable with? Furthermore, we said we were going to be generating a lot of publicity for our teams and expose the vehicles to the public. And we've given a lot of indication of that in the last year and a half, but it's been very low level. Our launch was a pretty high-profile event. Of course, we have to wait and see for the next week or so how much press we get. But I think it'll be a little bit of a demonstration that we will be effective in generating the kind of publicity we want. And moreover, now that we can talk openly about Progressive Insurance as our partner, I think that is a partner that the auto industry should feel very comfortable with.
Yes.
Progressive being a company that a little different from some other insurance companies in that they insure both cars and motorcycles. Many of them don't insure both. They're also the only insurance company to insure the Segway. So they are really looking to the future and realize that the market for these vehicles, whoever produces them, is going to be a big market. Progressive wants to be in a position to insure those vehicles, so it's a great business decision for them. Plus, for us, it's a great partnership because they have a motivation that these vehicles be safe. And they'll be helping us to make sure that they're safe, and that'll be, I think, reassuring to the car companies as well as to the consumers.
There was a comment by the CEO of Progressive during the announcement that I really liked. He said that he considered the money they gave to the prize as an investment in the future of cars, and therefore an investment in their own future.
Yeah, I thought that was very well put, too. I mean, they believe passionately as individuals. When we first started to talk with them, Glenn Renwick, their CEO, said, look, I love what you're doing. And if it were a personal decision of mine, I would say right away, let's do it. But I have, I'm the CEO. I have to be careful how I spend the company's money, and it has to make business sense. I have to be able to justify it to the board. And we went through a long process of analysis and sales and all of that. And when he was able to stand up and say that in an authoritative way, I think it was very meaningful.
Progressive stepping up was really great. You must have been in talks with other companies as well, though. Can you talk about that?
In general terms, I'll talk about it. We've been in more conversations about sponsorship than I think anybody in our team wishes that we had. I mean, it's been nonstop, lots of companies. They range from, it's kind of obvious, we talk to tire companies, we have talked to oil companies, we need a fuel provider, for example. a lot of talking with the auto supply industry, which is a big motivation to get involved with these vehicles. It's a separate topic we should talk about, actually, the reasons for that. Tire companies, auto supply, electronics, auto electronics, which is a booming market. And these vehicles, I think, will have a heavier dose of electronics when they do come to market
for sure.
than others. So we've been talking to lots of companies that are a very natural fit for the auto, sort of the auto business. And our experience was, it's a little bit like Progressive in that most of them said, we love what you're doing. We can see how it could be good for our business and how it would be good for us to be associated with it. But most of them were kind of, they would go up to the line and say, you know, we don't want to lead this, but come back to us when you're launched.
And we can give you a little more.
Yeah. So now we'll be going back to many of these companies and some new ones. Now that sort of the full complexion of what we're doing is a little bit more definite, and I think we'll have a very receptive audience. And in fact, we've already had a number of companies come forward without our going to them saying, now we want to hear more about this. This could make a lot of sense for us.
So does that mean the prize could possibly get bigger, or how would
One
you...
of our goals is to grow the purse.
Wow, that's interesting news.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so let's return to what you said about automotive parts companies. How is that related?
Let me give you an analogy. When the Clean Air Act was passed and there were all kinds of new requirements on emissions, people were screaming about how you know, that was going to hurt the economy, it was going to raise the price of cars, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it turned out to create a booming market in emissions equipment and emissions control equipment. And the auto suppliers made a ton of money, catalytic converters and all kinds of things. And we've actually quantified this, and you can actually see how these advances in emission control have fueled the business development of auto suppliers. I mean, the OEMs, they don't make the stuff themselves. They get it from elsewhere.
Yeah.
Another example is automotive safety. A lot of safety equipment. The obvious example being airbags. Auto electronics is booming these days, and it's the auto suppliers that are benefiting from that. So we look at the prospects for super efficient vehicles and super clean vehicles. My personal opinion is it's electronics and information technology that's going to have a great deal to do with that. And there are going to be new innovations in engine controls and engine parts. There may be maybe even new types of engines. Obviously, I mean, batteries is a huge area. And I think that's going to happen, you know, without us, but we'll help make that happen. So all of that, writ large, is the auto supply business, and it's not the OEM business. And that's why the auto suppliers are very interested in what we're doing.
Okay, so you said you might be growing the prize. Can you talk about how you might allocate that additional money? Would it go straight into the main prize, or?
So it's been undetermined as of yet. There are three or four areas where we'd like to put additional money. First of all, we would like to grow the purse for the winner, the main winner. Even though it's true that for a company that is actually going to take a production-capable design and put it into production and sale, certainly $10 million is chump change, and even $100 million is not even...
Yeah. Tesla just showed $100 million wasn't enough.
Yeah. So, you know, we're well aware of that, and everybody knows it. That said, from the public's viewpoint, the bigger the purse, the bigger the more the eyeballs. So it's kind of symbolic, number one. Number two, for some of the smaller teams that are hoping to promote their technology and maybe license technology or perhaps get acquired, a significant purse actually is attractive, and it's certainly attractive for academic teams and the like. Furthermore, right now we're splitting the purse 3-1 between the mainstream and the alternative class just for the first place winner. And in the tradition of motorsports, I personally would like to see us reward more than first place. I think that would be rather interesting. And if all we have to work with is $10 million, that starts to look not so interesting.
First place is going to be like $4 million.
Another place we might put money as I'm sure you're aware, we from the beginning have had a concept of a production intent category, and the genesis of this actually came from conversations with the OEMs, because they rightly said to us, look, if we were to enter with a vehicle that is not just production capable, but is production ready or in production or seriously moving towards production, the odds are it won't perform as well as a production capable vehicle that's tuned to win the race. They'd like to draw the contrast more starkly than we would. They would like to say, so you have experimental designs and you have real cars. We don't think that that's a fair distinction, because we're going to work very hard to make sure that these are production-capable vehicles. Nevertheless, it really is a fair point. The vehicle is truly to be ready for sale and meet all of the emissions and safety requirements, plus have all of the comfort and convenience that the consumer demands. It's probably going to be heavier and probably going to be a little less efficient, so maybe it's not as likely to win the race. Yet
for your purposes, it's a more important car. Yeah,
because it can win in the marketplace, so they should be encouraged, and we should remove the possibility of their being embarrassed by not winning. So we don't want to make an implicit judgment by having them not win it. In fact, they have a great car that performs very well. That was the genesis of having the production intent category. The idea was vehicles that are production ready, and there's a term of art in the auto industry where a vehicle has been validated, is what it is, which means it's a serious engineering thing. So vehicles that have been validated as production ready, and we would have to have a way to judge them, setting aside how we would judge it. We would give these vehicles a special label. They might have an extra logo. We would track them separately in the races. So in the standings, you could see overall standings. You could see standings among the production intent vehicles. In the real-time tracking, you might have a different icon for those vehicles that were production intent. The idea being to promote to the public, these are vehicles that are closer to reality. In fact, you can buy these. We might require, for example, that the manufacturer be accept deposits during the races.
Yes. So they have wait lists.
So we would want to promote them to the consumer as being especially noteworthy. The idea would be that maybe this is something that would make it easier for an OEM to make the decision to compete. We haven't refined that too much. It's on the list in the revision topics. We're thinking of renaming the category as manufacturer's category. That has a little bit more resonance with the intent of this design. But that's what it is. It's not a separate class like alternative, mainstream, and production. It's a special label within those classes. And that is another area where it might be interesting to have some money applied, although obviously it would mean nothing to them, but symbolically it might mean something to them.
I like renaming it because I think it's very confusing to talk about production capable and production intent. The difference between those two in the public mind is not going to be large. But if you say manufacturers...
Yeah, I think you're right.
One of the things that you said in the comments to the draft guidelines was that there's a possible division of the alternative class into two sort of subclasses. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Originally... the alternative class was defined as, we didn't really care how many wheels, but we required side-by-side seating for two people. They could have more than two people, we didn't care, but we wanted side-by-side. Our reason for doing that is we were making a judgment about expectations in the marketplace, and we were also feeling that tandem seating gave such an engineering advantage because of the cross-section issue, that if we didn't say side-by-side, we would be flooded with alternative class entries that were tandem. Tandem would win, and if that wasn't a really good match for the market, that didn't feel right.
It would undermine your goals.
Exactly. We got more feedback on that than any other rule in the draft guidelines, and people said, you know, who are you to prejudge the market? And of course, they were correct.
Mm-hmm.
We gnashed our teeth a little bit and finally decided that that was correct. When you had side-by-side seating and no requirement on the number of wheels, we didn't worry at all about even the possibility of two-wheel vehicles because it starts to get,
they're too wide.
They're just too wide. But once we said it could be tandem, we had to seriously think about people proposing two wheels. And that we didn't like at all because we didn't want to have an enclosed motorcycle. While we haven't fully refined how we're going to handle this, the two features that we're zeroing in are is that we'll say we don't care how many wheels, but it has to be statically and dynamically stable. So,
which means it won't tip over.
It won't tip over when you're stopped, and it won't tip over when you're riding, and the driver doesn't need to, cannot be thinking about leaning or those issues. You only have two wheels, you have to have some kind of fancy control system that takes care of all that. And, you know, when you look at the Segway, you can say to yourself, well, that's not out of the realm of possibility.
Yeah. In fact, several teams, I mean, I think there's a couple of three-wheel teams who intend to tilt, but the tilt is going to be, you know, controlled by the machine rather than by
right.
the rider.
Yeah. Right. And I don't imagine seeing that in two wheels, but our job is to write the specs and not try to anticipate some genius who thinks about how to do it with just two wheels. And then on the issue of unfairly giving an advantage to narrow cross-section tandem seat vehicles, what we decided is that we would split the purse in the alternative class, and we would award, we haven't quite decided how we would split it, but basically, we want to make sure, so if there's only one vehicle that is side-by-side seating, they would, in effect, be guaranteed to get a chunk of the purse. They would not have an incentive to move over to tandem seating simply in order to show well and possibly win the race. And that's why we said we will split the purse. And I think that the candidate way of doing that is based on the ratio of the number of entries we get in both categories of tandem versus side-by-side, but I frankly can't remember at this moment.
I've seen concept cars, especially electric vehicles, that have towable trailers that contain generators. Are you going to allow that kind of thing in the race?
Probably not. I'm pausing so long because I think I have to say it depends on the design. It's not something we've thought a lot about. There are lots of issues, safety being a main one, how it would affect maneuverability, but presumably that would be built into how they perform. And I'm not sure, I guess we would treat it as a composite vehicle in terms of energy and emissions. It's really not clear to me from an engineering viewpoint how that would be an advantage unless it's a trailer that would only be used for long trips, for example, whereas for short city runs, it wouldn't be used.
Well, just to give more context, I saw, you know the RAV4 EV? Yeah, Toyota commissioned a project with accelerated propulsion, I think it's called, and they built a trailer that could be rented and towed behind the RAV4 EV for longer trips.
Yeah. You know, one of the reasons I've been hesitant is that a number of people have wondered if we would allow road where several vehicles hooked up together.
Yeah, hypermiling.
And we're kind of not inclined to do that. But I guess I would have to say that if it didn't introduce safety issues and it was the solution for the longer trips, then why not? But that's not a commitment. I think it would depend on the design. And
okay, so this may still be an open issue to be decided.
Yeah, and it may remain open until somebody... I don't think we would flat out say... It doesn't seem reasonable to me to flat out say it has to be a single vehicle. You know, somebody puts on a roof rack with a generator for long trips, why not allow them to tow something?
Yeah, exactly.
I guess I hesitate because I'm skeptical about the marketability of that solution, and that is a priority of ours to have something that would be attractive to consumers. So I can say confidently that flat out we wouldn't prohibit it, but the application would have to meet all of our requirements for, you know, safety, manufacturability,
and
business
emissions.
Plan,
little
and
portable
emissions.
Generators are often emissions.
Yep. And of course, emissions. So.
That's my answer, and I'm sticking to it.
Okay, is there anything else you think you should let us know about?
Can't think of any obvious things.
Okay, well, I think we'll end here then. Thanks for talking to us.
You're welcome, Eric.
And that concludes my interview with John Shore, Senior Director of the Progressive Automotive XPRIZE. If you'd like to learn more, you can visit my website at xprizecars.com, or you can visit the Progressive Automotive XPRIZE website at progressiveautoxprize.org. This has been the sixth episode of the XPRIZE Cars podcast. Thanks for listening.